Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, it's Angela, and today I'm here with John and with Deborah, and we're taking on an issue you see regularly in your practice, and that is the role of mental health and also of medication in your clients' lives. Now, I want to start by saying that, of course, none of us are clinicians, and you're not expected to be a clinician either. But because mental health often plays such a key role in our clients' lives and in the cases themselves, you need to have enough information and enough confidence in this area to be able to ask the right questions. So today we're going to talk a little bit about statistics. We're going to talk about some experience, and we're going to point you to some resources so that you are able to question professionals when you need to protect your client.
And I think this, we recognize that this could be review for some of our listeners, but I think it's important review for experienced practitioners because it keeps it at the forefront of your mind. So let's talk about the study done by the National Institute of Health and published in May of 2023 on children who receive Medicaid and comparing non-foster care children with foster care children who were dispensed at least one prescription for a psychotropic medication. Children who are not in foster care on Medicaid, 8% of them were prescribed at least one psychotropic medication. The number for kids in foster care is 35%. So what's that disparity about? And when we talk about psychotropic medication, what do we mean?
Yeah, John, as you know, I've done the policy side of dependency for a long time and now have just started taking some cases. So I have not personally represented a kid who has had medication be an issue at the forefront of his or her case. But I do know that psychotropic medication is different in nature from other medications that children may be given either from their parents or when you identified a need once they come into care. So for any other new folks, air quotes, new folks, psychotropic medication is unique because it alters the chemical levels in a child's brain that impact mood and behavior. So it affects mental state, it affects how people process information and how you perceive your surroundings. So you can see that this is a very different situation that one might be monitoring if the child you're representing is given medication. John, what is it that occurred to you when you heard the pretty significant disparity in statistics? I mean, that's more than four times.
It's actually 6.8 times. They have 6.8 times higher odds of being prescribed a psychotropic medication than their non-foster peers. And that rings true to me based on my years of representing kids. I've done a lot of work in the area. I tried to work up a class action, honestly, against the pharmaceutical companies at one point. It did not go anywhere, but we almost got to the filing stage. So a lot of work into this, a lot of research into this issue. And I've thought, is it because non-foster care youth do not have a parent in the room with the doctor? That's just one of the theories I've thought over the years, is that if a doctor is thinking of prescribing to a child and there's a parent in the room, is that a factor? Because we know that the foster care youth, for the most part, do not have a parent in the room with them when they're being prescribed a drug. Is there pressure from placements, case managers, whatever, to control children's behavior more so than non-foster care youth? I don't know. But other than those factors, I think in recent years, the why is coming into focus more. Deborah, right? We know about the work of Dr. Nadine Burke and others regarding ACEs.
And so by ACEs, and I think the vast majority of people are aware of this, but we always try not to do acronyms, but the adverse childhood experiences. And for those of you who have not seen Dr. Harris's TED Talk, it's really engaging. And it's probably, I think, 10 minutes. You can listen and understand how things that happen to children, whether it's witnessing domestic violence or experiencing poverty long term, can actually be tracked to health conditions. Things that you might not even think of can be linked to the number of ACEs that someone has experienced. A lot of the neglect cases are rooted in poverty. I mean, by definition, these children will have experienced probably one, two, upwards of four or five adverse childhood experiences. So now we're looking at behavior and we're trying to determine how to put a family back together or make the child successful and thrive in a particular placement. And so now the question becomes, is the answer to this psychotropic medication?
And this is where the phrase, I'm not a clinician, but comes into play, right? Because I have to gain credibility with the court right away and acknowledge, Judge, I'm not asking you to second guess the expert, but I'm saying there might be a missing piece here in this puzzle that might be accounting for why these kids are getting over-medicated. One of them, I think, Deborah, you just hit on, I think that's the main one, is that these kids' ACEs score are so high compared to their non-foster peers. I think that's probably a fair assumption on my part, is that kids in foster care have higher ACEs scores than kids not in foster care. But I do think the lack of a parent in the room, anyone who's been in a room with a pediatrician knows, or a doctor knows, that the parent plays a role. The parent plays a role in what care is delivered on some level, right? The doctor turns to the parent for feedback. It does not surprise me, because over the years, when I open a file, I expect the kid to be on medication at this point, honestly. That's why we're doing this podcast, I think, is because this problem is so intractable. And it is a problem because, and this is not to say no child should be on medication, right? We are not clinicians. That's why we're calling it this podcast by that title. But at the same time, 6.8 times more likely to be prescribed medication, there has to be a problem. There has to be something we're missing. And I don't think we're missing it anymore. I think we know what it is. I just don't think we know what to do about it yet, which is why we think Dr. Burke Harris's talk is so important for children's attorneys to hear, because it will educate you more on what the cause of the over-medication and intractability of treatment, and why medication doesn't always seem to work so well, and even talk therapy might not be working so well, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what to do to make the problem better.
Well, and I want to add, John, as you were saying, gaining credibility with the judge and acknowledging that we're not clinicians. If you've ever had a friend or family member or child who's been through the process of accessing medication, you will realize how little that professional knows that child, and that the decisions to prescribe medications are often based on the adult's description of the child's behaviors. If you are following the practice philosophy and you have spent a lot of time with your client and you know their history, you may in fact know quite a bit more than the clinician in the case about your client. And so it doesn't mean that it makes it simple to come into court and say, throw out the meds. It's not that simple, but the truth of the matter is, oftentimes the psychiatrist prescribing these medicines are spending a very small amount of time with your client.
When you first learn that a child is being either referred to take a psychotropic medication or is scheduled for some sort of evaluation for the purpose of correcting a particular behavior through medication, as the child's attorney, and still, again, not a clinician, what's the first thing you do?
Well, I look from a forest level, I look for like consistency of treatment, right? Because, you know, the kids we serve tend to go from placement to placement. And the more serious their emotional and mental health needs, the more likely they are to move from placement to placement, even if they're doing well, right? So I look for consistency of treatment. Like, if the child's been with the same psychiatrist for 3 years, then I'm going to assume this doctor, even if he's only spending 15 minutes at a time with the child, at least has some history and knows the client somewhat. So I look for consistency of treatment. And the other thing is I look at the size of the cocktail, right? What's in the cocktail that the kid is being given? How big is it? If it's a long list of medications, I start to think, well, and I've had these cases in my life where they've put a Band-Aid on it and they can still see the blood coming through the wound. So they put another Band-Aid on that. And what if we put this bandage on? And then pretty, you know, there's 8 Band-Aids on something. And it's like, at this point, we need to go and put some stitches on that or something. It's not, we got to start peeling the Band-Aids off because someone has been just medicating perhaps the side effect of the medication. You know, that's what it feels like. Again, I'm not a clinician, but sometimes it just feels like that. And so I look at the list and then I look in the list and with experience, and this can come not with experience or just some simple research, I look for the drugs that are actually adult antipsychotics. So I look for the adult antipsychotics and I automatically question, what are they doing? Why is the child on this? But when you see a name, when you start to learn these names and you look at it and you go, lithium. I haven't had a client on lithium in 2 years. And here's a client on lithium. I'm going to inquire. So I'm not a clinician, but we all have common sense and we have critical thinking skills. And then, of course, the other common one is Adderall. And I won't go into it, but there are reasons to question the diagnosis of ADHD in foster care youth. And one of the reasons is they can't all be ADHD, okay? They can't all have ADHD. And the percentage of my clients who have been diagnosed as ADHD, I'm sorry, it just can't be. So again, I'm not a clinician, but it can't be the percentage that it is. So you have to question that. And if you listen to Dr. Burke Harris, and I'm name dropping her again because I just heard her speak last week, but listen to her TED talk and you will learn a lot about why you should question the ADHD diagnosis and the prescription of Adderall. There are other medications that may work better and that Adderall may be counterproductive. So you just want to check that. Doesn't mean it is. It doesn't mean your client doesn't have ADHD. They may have ADHD. It's not our role to diagnose or give a second opinion. It's just our role to question and make sure that everyone has done their due diligence and that the provider has the history.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we're talking about sort of two extremes in medications, psychotropic medications having some really serious long-term effects. For years, people were talking about this, and young people who had been in foster care until they aged out and had been on these drugs, taking that during the day, but then needing something to sleep and then something to wake up, just being on like around-the-clock medications to function, and then aging out of care, being on no medication, and finally feeling like themselves again. Sometimes we have clients that have real mental health diagnoses that need treatment for them to function. And a lot of times we have clients who are just in a bad situation, have ACEs, and are struggling to function because they don't feel safe in their placement. They don't know where they're going to be in a month. So I want to point everybody back to the one legal problem that we often talk about, which is that it may be that all of these symptoms that are being checked off or used to medicate a child are a function of the fact that they don't live in a permanent placement. They don't know where they're going to be. The uncertainty. I mean, those things alone can create all sorts of symptoms. And so even as we're pointing to this medication issue and saying, question it and look into it, you never want to take your eye off the ball of making sure that the main focus is getting this child back home or to a permanent placement, because oftentimes we find that once that is resolved, a lot of these medications do fall away. Not always. So asking the questions when you see any medication, really, and just understanding, but also remembering that sometimes it is a function of either their history, which will not change, or where they currently are living. And if they're in a group home and they don't have the nurturing adult in their lives, they don't have a parent that's able to engage, all of those things cause us to stay focused on the main issue in the case.
And that's where the children's attorney's job, I think, can become difficult. Is I've got my goal for the case. I've got my client's legal problem. I know all their needs are best met in the context of a family, but my client is struggling so mightily that I can't get them stable, and everything we try seems to fail. And I think representing the older youth or even younger youth with serious issues like this, it's very difficult, and it can feel like pushing a boulder up a hill. But I'm going to go back to Dr. Burke Harris and borrow something else she said, because it did resonate with me. She said, with ACEs, we are essentially treating, it's like treating people with cancer only when they reach stage four, when it becomes symptomatic. With ACEs, we're still waiting until it's symptomatic. And with our older youth especially, and that growing population of older youth in foster care across the nation, they're symptomatic. Their ACEs are symptomatic at this point. And what are the treatments that work? The medication doesn't always seem to have the desired effect. The client might say, I don't mind the medication, but they're still getting in trouble. But you're like, but geez, if I advocate to take them off the medication, is it going to get worse? You can't prove a negative. You don't know what to do. It's difficult. One thing that we do in my office with a special portion of our clients who are extremely traumatized, we actually look at their ACEs score and we gather that data on them early on in the case. So we know how severe their ACEs were in life. And then what we try to do is we can't make those go away, right? What does that child have to do now? That child needs to learn how to cope and live and function with those adverse childhood experiences. So if talk therapy is not making a dent and medication is not really doing anything, then fine. Keep them on the medication if it's not having bad side effects. We're not going to, you know, to pretend we're clinicians. But we're going to try and help our clients succeed by building their self-esteem. And this is the type of treatment that the University of Western Michigan espoused many years ago. And that's where we learned about it. You try to build a client's self-esteem. And the way you do that is you get them to engage in something, pro-social is the word people use now, but any kind of activity, positive activity that they enjoy. And why do we want to do that? Because ACEs basically causes your fight or flight switch to be stuck in the on position, right? It's constantly, it's like a live wire sparking inside your body. Self-esteem is like electrical tape wrapped around that sparking live wire in your body. So it's still sparking when you get triggered. If someone yells at you or tries to correct your behavior, you might get triggered with shame or guilt or whatever, and it might trigger your fight or flight response. But that spark is wrapped hopefully a little bit in some self-esteem, and it tempers your reaction. So you are now functioning. You are now not getting arrested. You are not reacting with violence, maybe. You're not running away. So that's what we're trying to do with our resilience project, where we test their ACEs score, and then we administer the Connor-Davidson resiliency scale to see how they're improving as we work with them and get them involved in pro-social activities, working towards the day that they will have a family, find a family, create a family of their own, and will be able to function better and leave foster care successfully, which is the goal, is to get them safely and permanently out of foster care.
I just wanted to restate what I heard you say, which is you may have a file where children are on medication, or you may be in a staffing where medication is being recommended. Your first thing that you're doing is, what am I looking at here? What is this for? Then if I understood what you just talked about, then you're looking at, are there other supports? What is there other therapy like talk therapy? Are there any efforts to shore up the child's self-esteem? Any other pro-social activities? That sounds like a little package maybe that you're trying to watch for. Did I have that right?
I mean, if I have a client who loves their therapist and is succeeding in therapy and is happy, then great, continue in therapy. But if their behavior is still going off the rails, then something else is needed. And if they're on two medications or three medications and their behavior is still not great, then I'm going to question, what's this one for? And it's very hard to get some psychiatrists to talk to you in my experience, because I'm a lawyer. I can't get them to even call me back because I'm a lawyer and they deal in 15-minute appointments. There are some out there who have talked to me over the years, and those that have talked to me have said, this is their words, not mine. Look, our profession has largely become about writing prescriptions. That's their words, not mine. Those are the ones who will talk to me. The other ones don't want to talk to me simply because I'm a lawyer. Getting a second opinion for our listeners is going to be very difficult. In our state, we are blessed with the University of Florida Med Consult line, which is okay. So we can call there at the University of Florida and we can say, here's my client, here's their diagnoses. Here's the medications they're on. Do you have any thoughts? And they will give you feedback that seems appropriate, or they might say that dosage is too high for the child's weight. They might question why the child is on two of the same class of drug. So it's a worthwhile thing, because it's really hard as a children's lawyer to take your client for a second opinion. First of all, it's hard to get one psychiatrist to question another psychiatrist. And who's going to pay for it, right? Medicaid has already paid for a psychiatrist appointment. So there's all kinds of obstacles to second opinions. So you have to take the medication as you find it and then just try to question it and sometimes build a team or a coalition around it, like maybe the foster parent or the group home parent or even the therapist that you attend the treatment teams. And a treatment team meeting is a good place to say, because you got the doctor there, see? That's the one place you can get the doctor, usually at the treatment team. The psychiatrist might be there. And those things, in my experience, are like set for like 10 minutes, right? Okay, we're doing her treatment team. Boom, 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 boom. And you go, wait, I got a question. Why is she on an adult antipsychotic if she's in your facility? I'm not a clinician, but that's like something a mom would say is what I'm saying here. I'm not her mom, but it's something a parent, someone standing in the gap for that child would say, because the child doesn't have the sophistication or the experience to say it themselves. So questioning is important. Knowing your client is important. Knowing where the pressure points are, where you can apply pressure is important. Because look, we admit, Angela, this is an intractable problem for children's lawyers. It's a systemic, long-term issue for this population of kids that we serve.
And I think it's something that, again, if you've been in the field forever and you're like, what do you mean these are the statistics in 2023? We have known for 20 years what these drugs do to kids, and we're still not solving for them. So it is still, it's not talked about as much, but it's every bit as prevalent.
Yeah. One more thought on this that I had that I think is important to share, because I think it does speak to the frustration, I think, of working on these issues with kids is, Everything you try to do, sometimes it doesn't seem to work. It feels like you're rolling down a hill, and you sort of are. So you sort of are rolling down a hill. You're rolling down the pyramid, right? Do you remember Psychology 101 in college? The hierarchy of needs. So what we've found is that the kids who live in the empirically unsafe group homes, okay, where you might have a roommate tonight and tomorrow night, you might come home from school tomorrow and that kid might be gone and you got a different roommate and that kid might have a felony record. So if you're in one of those group homes and you're trying to, either through talk therapy, medication, or building self-esteem and resilience, move up the pyramid towards self-esteem and towards self-actualization and being able to control your behaviors and become a better, more functional person, you keep sliding back down to the first foundational level because you aren't safe, right? Isn't that what we all learned in Psych 101? You got to have that foundational, I am safe, I am fed, my basic needs are met, and then I can get up to the second level, and then I can get up to the third level, right? And so there is that thought to keep in mind, and it goes back to the one legal problem of trying to get your client safely and out of foster care permanently. Your client needs to be in a safe placement for a lot of this stuff to work, any of it to work. The medication is only going to have so much effect. The therapy is only going to have so much effect, any of it, if they're not in a safe, stable placement where they have that foundational element to build upon, that building block, which has probably been missing for a large portion of their lives.
As we've talked about this, maybe it seems a little hopeless, which is not really the intention of the podcast. The intention of the podcast was to try and first introduce why this medication issue is a serious concern for kids in foster care, but also to encourage children's attorneys who may be overwhelmed by this huge topic that requires specialized knowledge, to encourage people to find ways to advocate for their clients. We've talked about asking questions. We've talked about the possibility of getting a second opinion. But one of the things that we haven't talked about is the fact that sometimes the role of the child's attorney and the opportunity to make a significant difference and a positive difference for your child takes nothing more than getting people to follow the law. And there are a number of states that have very prescriptive statutes on whether and when a psychotropic medication can be administered to a child, how often that has to be reviewed, the nature of that review, on when and whether the medications are being administered and who needs to look at that. And likely, if you don't have those sort of things in your jurisdiction, your department may have an operating procedure. So if this is something that you're still trying to get your arms around, if you're trying to find a way to insert yourself in the conversation about whether or not there's value for your client in taking this medication that outweighs the potential side effects, just going and looking at the statutory scheme or the administrative rules or the department's procedure may give you the roadmap.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I think one other kind of foundational thing that we only talked about briefly, and that is that particularly with all clients, but particularly with older youth, spending the time to really talk to them about how they felt before the medication, what side effects are they feeling, really gathering that information from them so that when you do want to question it, you are questioning it on their behalf and not, again, just looking at the name and deciding that it is inherently a dangerous or bad drug. So I know you all out there know that you would want to talk to your client about this, but in these particular instances, particularly when you've got 3 and 4 medications ongoing, really having a clear understanding of the client's perspective of what's working, what's not, because that obviously needs to inform your actions on it.
And Angela, to build on what you're saying, if they are in a foster home, talking to the foster parents about the before or after, or even better, maybe a teacher, because hearkening back to what John said, if they're in a group home, they may not feel particularly safe there. There may be behaviors that are presenting there. Whereas if you go and look at some of the other environments that they have, that they're in, you may learn a very different story about what their behavior is and then have some sort of support if you need to get people to look more closely at the issue.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, Deborah, because that is another tool that I use when I see a diagnosis of a client. I go, okay, you're bipolar. Okay, you say she's bipolar, but I compare her behavior. I'll call the school. How she behaves at school compared to how she behaves in the group home. If the teachers love her and she's perfectly fine at school, I don't know if there's such a thing as selective bipolar, but I don't think there is. So no. It gives you some information, and it's evidence gathering, presenting your case to judges who are hungry for this kind of argument. They can't do it themselves on the bench, right? But if children's attorneys are in a key position to exert their power and influence over this subject matter, and I think the courts are more than anxious to hear these kinds of arguments to protect kids who are being over-medicated or just not receiving the right kind of treatment in addition to their medication.
So I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. And I would just remind everybody of the high points of this particular episode, and that is, one, really know your client, be talking to them about these medications and how they're making them feel. Know enough about the medications that are being prescribed to your client so that you can ask these questions, so that you know what the side effects are. And when you see this layering effect, you can really start to question that. And third, just look at the whole picture. Sometimes history is history, ACEs are there. What are the other elements to this package, per se, that will set your client up for success as best as you can? Thank you so much for listening. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.